content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kevin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we will continue with the article we started last time, titled The Secret Life of Cormac McCarthy by Richard Grant. And we will pick up when the author has met Cormac McCarthy's younger brother, Dennis McCarthy. Dennis McCarthy, the youngest of the six children, made his way through the book-choked hallway into the book-strewn living room. Retired lawyer, editor, and conservation biologist, Dennis published his first novel in 2021, a spiritual western about Billy the Kid. Now 81, he was fit and trim with blue eyes, a radiant smile, and a strong resemblance to Cormac. He was my best friend for 70 years and a fabulous older brother who always looked out for me, he said. We were very, very close. I asked him which authors his brother most admired. Moby Dick was Cormac's favorite book without question, and Faulkner was more of an influence than he'd like to admit, he said. He loved Hemingway's short stories, James Joyce, Dostoevsky, and Shakespeare, of course. Readers and scholars had already identified these literary forebears, but it was satisfying to hear them confirmed. Of the many thousands of books in the house, the basement, and outbuildings, how many had McCarthy actually read? If you exclude the encyclopedias and reference books, I would guess about 85%, Dennis said. Cormac kept on ordering books after he was too sick and frail to read, because it was a compulsion. But until that point, he would read for hours and hours nearly every day. He never left the house without a book. He never left the house without a gun. Both were equally unthinkable. Why was he always armed? He was a conservative country boy from the South who understood that the world is a dangerous place. When he was 24, McCarthy accidentally shot himself in the leg while practicing alone on a gun range in Tennessee. Dennis didn't know any more details because his brother refused to discuss the incident, but it was likely a quick draw gone wrong. When I asked Dennis about his brother's reputation as a recluse, he said it was totally inaccurate. He was very sociable and could get along with anybody. Well, almost anybody. He didn't suffer fools gladly or people who rushed up to him gushing about his books. But he had a lot of friends, and he loved dining and conversation and five-hour lunches that sometimes turned into 10-hour lunches. Those friends included physicist and quark discoverers Gell Mann and George Zweig, the whale biologist Roger Payne, the movie star Josh Brolin, plus a bar owner in Tucson who calls himself God, and a silver-tongued con man from Knoxville named John Shedden, who appears exactly as himself under his own name in McCarthy's penultimate novel, The Passenger. Brolin got to know McCarthy during the filming of No Country for Old Men, and was at the author's bedside the night before he died. It was me, his ex-wife, his son John, and that was it, Brolin tells me on the phone. He was telling these wild stories about drinking wine with Andre the Giant in Paris, and all this stuff was coming out totally lucid, sharp, funny, inspired. Then he would go into this lost dementia, and he'd be grabbing at stuff that wasn't there. Then he'd go to sleep, and then he'd wake up and tell another story. Soon after Brolin left, McCarthy drew his final breath. McCarthy's son John, the model for the boy character in The Road, was now 26 and sleeping in his father's old bedroom upstairs. He's a licensed pilot, a composer, and a musician. The first time I met John, he was coming sleepily down the wooden stairs in search of coffee. I just learned that Dennis had emptied two storage units full of books in El Paso and two more in Santa Fe and moved the boxes into the house for cataloging. So I'm getting a totally unrealistic picture of what the house was like when you were growing up here, I said to John. Not really, he said. This is pretty much how it was. Boxes everywhere. Piles of books everywhere. The hallway stacked up with boxes with a little path through the middle. Whole rooms so full of books you couldn't go in there. It didn't bother me at all. It was John who told me that McCarthy worked in a bed, a California king with high thread count sheets, the Olivetti on a wooden platform with a leather pillow underneath it, and piles of type pages, magazines, books, and catalogs. Writing, McCarthy once said, was not a conscious process for him. He put a blank piece of paper in the Olivetti, the words arrived, and he typed them down. But that was just the first stage of an extensive rewriting and structuring process, and some of his books took 20 years or more to get right. Dad didn't like being interrupted when he was working or when he was reading, John said. No, 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 I'm reading. Go away, he would say. But he was a great father, always there for me, and I learned so much from him. We would have these long conversations about science and history and music and whatever else, and he was the funniest person I'd ever met, just a natural comedian. I asked John what else his father collected apart from books, cars, and kitchenware. I would say clothes were the other big one. He had hundreds of tweed jackets, hundreds of shirts, hundreds of suits that he'd never worn. John once spent 3 days dragging stuff out of a room he wanted to use as a bedroom. When I was done, I said, "You ever think you might be a little bit of a hoarder?" And he looks at me and he goes, "Yeah, probably." He attributed it to all those years when he had no money. Dennis isn't buying that explanation. Cormac lived in chaos, which I found fascinating because he had such a fabulous artistic sense. He would design things beautifully and he dressed impeccably, but his living quarters were always a disaster. He was an incredibly complicated individual. The cataloging scholars could only spare 4 or 5 days at a time. Then they would go back to their jobs for a few months and try to carve out another long weekend in New Mexico. The stalwarts were Peebles and Rick and Jonathan Elmore, whip-smart twin brothers who looked nothing alike, taught at different colleges, and wrote academic papers together about McCarthy's work. The cataloging was dusty, repetitive, eye-straining work, but it was conducted with good humor and camaraderie, and you never knew what might come out of the next box. One afternoon, after looking through a batch about Cistercian abbeys, violin makers, metaphysics, meta-ontology, the incest taboo, and the material foundations of ancient Mesopotamian civilization, I said, "Was there anything he wasn't interested in? Sewing, perhaps?" "Nope," said Jonathan Elmore, an English professor at Louisiana Tech University. "We've cataloged books on needlework and quilting." Rick noted McCarthy's keen interest in clothes and fashion, which could, I granted, be described as sewing-related. McCarthy was a longtime subscriber to the fashion and style magazine W, and had annotated many of his books about menswear. In his copy of The Suit, A Machiavellian Approach to Men's Style, McCarthy penciled his opinion on the slip dress shoes. Disgusting. Further down on the same page, next to a sentence praising shiny buckled monk strap shoes, he wrote, "Yet more horror." The scholars treated annotations like pieces of treasure and would read them aloud to each other. Inside Reclaiming History, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, they found notes on a slip of paper, including a line about the assassin's bullet. "It was going like a bat out of hell when it left the president's head in that crowd. It is a pure freak of chance that it didn't take out a citizen spectator." The historical figures who interested McCarthy the most, judging by the number of books he owned about them, were Albert Einstein, 114 books, Winston Churchill, 88, and James Joyce, 78. Architecture is the dominant subject in the collection with 855 books. The human being with whom McCarthy most admired, Dennis confirms, was Ludwig Wittgenstein. The team cataloged a staggering 142 books by or about the philosopher, the high proportion annotated. McCarthy's fascination with Wittgenstein came as a surprise to the scholars, but it makes sense. As Rick Elmore, a philosophy professor at Appalachian State University, with floral tattoos climbing up his neck, puts it, "Wittgenstein was always asking how the systems we use to represent the world relate to the world we want to represent." It's one of the central questions in McCarthy's work. With the exception of Moby Dick and multiple gorgeous leather-bound editions, scholars found hardly any novels until they started cutting open boxes that Dennis retrieved from a storage locker in El Paso. Out came the entire canon of Western literature, from ancient Greece and Rome to the best novelists, poets, and essayists of the 1970s, nearly all in cheap, worn paperback editions. These are the books that he read in his 20s and 30s and maybe into his 40s. And he was broke that whole time, said Dennis. Once he had money, Cormack bought all his books in hardback if possible. And for the last 40 years of his life, he read almost no fiction at all. Why? The answer stems from McCarthy's deeply disparaging view of modernist society, which he considered lost, divorced from nature, history, and tradition, and heading towards social collapse and apocalypse. Cormack considered contemporary fiction a waste of time, said Dennis, because contemporary writers no longer have a legitimate culture to feed their souls. One afternoon, Dennis was marveling at McCarthy's storytelling abilities and comedic talents, and I had asked him if there was anything apart from housekeeping that his brother had been bad at. He thought about it for a moment and said, "Marriage." McCarthy was married and divorced 3 times. His wives needed more than he gave them, Dennis said. The work always came first for Cormack. He loved those women, but he loved himself more. He was a narcissist. And if he hadn't been a narcissist, he never would have achieved the same heights of artistic greatness. The most enduring love of McCarthy's life was a woman named Augusta Britt. As she revealed last year in interviews with Vanity Fair magazine, they began a sexual relationship when she was 17 and he was 43. And he took her to Mexico to evade the FBI, who were after him for statutory rape and Mann Act violations. Britt had said she didn't feel sexually exploited and credits McCarthy for saving her life by rescuing her from an abusive situation in Tucson. But some readers and commentators have found McCarthy's behavior with her beyond the pale. Britt declined to comment for this piece. McCarthy and Britt were together as a couple for about 4 years. Even after they split up, he never stopped loving her, Dennis said. He continued to see her on a regular basis, and they maintained a close relationship for the rest of his life. Piece by piece, the inscrutable mystique that McCarthy built around himself is falling away. 2 biographies are on the way to publication, one by a friend of McCarthy's named Lawrence Gonzalez, the other by literary biographer Tracy Doherty. And Britt might collaborate on a book with Vincenzo Barini, who wrote her story in Vanity Fair. We also have McCarthy's library, which perhaps more than any other source can illuminate the mind of a man who, as Peebles says, built his life on books. On the first day of the final cataloging session, Peebles let out a hooting sound upon finding a dead bat at the bottom of a box. The downstairs of the house had been steadily accumulating dust for more than 2 years since McCarthy's death, and it was still crammed with books. The McCarthy scholars, Cormackians as they call themselves, repacked the catalog books, wrote the date, and cataloged CMS for Cormac McCarthy Society, and stacked them up wherever space could be found. The annotated books went into separate boxes marked annotated or were piled up on the pool table. The dead bat was left in the bottom of a book box. When the project began, Peebles had hoped that all the books could be together in a single collection in some sort of Cormac McCarthy Memorial Building, but that wasn't panning out. Dennis had arranged for the annotated books to join his brother's papers, which include the notes and drafts for his entire body of work, at the Whitcliffe Collections Archive at Texas State University. The Santa Fe Institute wanted a selection of the most intellectually rigorous academic books for a small library it was planning to build in honor of McCarthy. The rest of the books were going to the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, where he enrolled twice and failed to graduate. In the digital realm, however, McCarthy's library will live on as a complete entity, and the public will be able to inspect its catalog titles free of charge. Our goal, right from the outset, was to create an open-access database listing all the books in his collection, Peebles said. Anyone who wants to know what books McCarthy was reading and whether he annotated them will be able to log on and access that information. The University of South Carolina has agreed to build a website for this purpose and to publish a monograph by Peebles about the cataloging project. There's talk of scanning all the annotations at some point and making them available on the website, but that is still theoretical. Almost exactly a year after the project began, Peebles opened the very last box. Perhaps the best adjective for its contents is Cormackian. Peebles pulled them out and announced books about Mexican architecture and the French Renaissance court, Kierkegaard's metaphors and the Texas Rangers, the neurobiology of mental illness, architecture and society in Normandy from 1120 to 1270, and the Gun Digest Book of Assault Weapons. She was unable to calculate the total number of books because the cataloging software didn't account for multi-volume works. McCarthy's 36-volume History of Utah, for example, registered as a single entity, nor did the software tally multiple editions of the same book. So McCarthy's 13 copies of Moby Dick registered as one entity. The total number of entries was 18,520. Taking into account duplicate copies and multi-volume works, Peebles felt confident that McCarthy's library contained just over 20,000 books with 2,170 annotated. Driving away from the house with the taste of old book dust in my mouth, I marveled at the extraordinary force of McCarthy's curiosity. I thought about the books on acousto-optics and lay intellectuals in the 9th-century Carolingian Empire. The $2,200 he spent on the 8 volumes of Horace Walpole's collected letters, the $10,000 in several uncashed royalty checks that he used as a bookmark in the memoir of William Faulkner's niece. To peer into someone's library is to peer into their brain, and here it seemed was a mind that wanted to know everything. Next, we'll move on to an article called High on the Bog by Jenny Rothenberg Gritz. In eastern Massachusetts, collecting cranberries from flooded wetlands is an annual ritual and a shimmering spectacle from land and air. Each fall in eastern Massachusetts, people gather to watch the cranberry harvest. The berries grow in a dry bog over the course of 16 months, and in October or November, farmers flood the area with water. A machine known colloquially as egg beater knocks the tiny red orbs off of their vines, and they float to the surface, making it easy for workers to corral them and pump them into a nearby truck. It's a visually mesmerizing process, and photographer Joanna L. Steidel knew she wanted to capture it from above with a drone. Carver, Massachusetts, is home to the Ocean Spray Cooperative, and it's enormous, Steidel said, referring to the company that sells the leading brand of cranberry juice. The farms were up and down the whole road. As we were flying the drone, we could see massive empty trucks coming into the bogs and full trucks leaving. Long before the descendants of European colonists began growing cranberries on such a grand scale, the native Wampanoag people used to pick the wild varieties called Sassumanish, adding them to squash, puddings, breads, and meat. They used the berries medicinally to reduce fevers and swelling. Cranberries may have well been on the table at that very first Thanksgiving in 1621, but the newly arrived English families sat down with their Wampanoag neighbors to celebrate the harvest. The berries became a staple of the autumn holiday, mainly because they ripened at the right time of year. The 1796 edition of American Cookery, the first cookbook published in the United States, included a recipe for a cranberry dessert, as well as recipes for turkey, potatoes, and apple pie. The author, Amelia Simmons, who described herself as an American orphan, also gave detailed instructions on how to cook and dress a turtle, but that dish never made it to the traditional Thanksgiving table. Nobody actively cultivated and marketed cranberries until 1816, when Henry Hall, a Massachusetts farmer and Revolutionary War veteran, noticed that the wild cranberries on his property thrived when sand blew over them. The sand helped push the roots of the vines more deeply into earth, which made them more productive. It also proved to be a natural form of pest control and suppressed weeds and fungi. Hall started intentionally growing the berries that way, and others copied his methods. Massachusetts soon became known for its enormous cranberry industry. In the early days, harvesting the berries was extremely labor-intensive. Farmers and their families had to pick each individual berry by hand. In the 1880s, people began making use of a newly invented cranberry scoop. The top of the tool was designed to rake through the vines, loosening the berries, which would then fall into a receptacle. During cranberry picking season, local schools excused children so they could help their families scoop up all the berries. In 1912, Marcus L. Uran, the head of the United Cape Cod Cranberry Company, began canning cranberry sauce for year-round use. He also innovated the cranberry syrup that became a staple for mixed drinks. Over time, Uran joined forces with other cranberry companies, and the enterprise evolved into Ocean Spray, which began producing its now familiar jellied cranberry log in 1941. Ocean Spray is still a cooperative of around 700 separate cranberry growers. Starting in the 1960s, farmers began flooding their bogs, which cut down dramatically on labor. Most types of berries can't be harvested in this way. They would sink to the bottom. But each cranberry has four air pockets inside, an evolutionary feature that makes it easier for the berries to float downstream and spread their seeds to new areas. Farmers in previous eras had figured out that they could separate ripe cranberries from overripe and underripe ones by testing how well they bounced. The same buoyancy allowed ripe berries to float to the surface of a flooded bog, making it much easier for harvesters to scoop them up and transport them to the processing plant. When Steidel set out to photograph the harvest last fall, she contacted Betty Wiley, a fellow photographer she knew and admired via Instagram. Wiley had lived on Cape Cod for nearly two decades, and she'd spent many autumn days documenting the cranberry harvesting process. "I have images at ground level, lying on my stomach with the cranberries flying," Wiley said. "When it's sunny outside and the light hits the cranberries, they're just this brilliant shade of red. It's absolutely beautiful." The scene was entirely different from above, as Steidel and Wiley watched workers use long, movable barrels called booms to nudge the cranberries together. "We're getting bit by bugs, we're feeling the sun on our face, we're watching these people hard at work, not missing a beat with all this machinery, and the berries are floating up in different abstract designs and swirls," Steidel said. "You're just sitting there and the whole shape is changing." Ever since Steidel began first operating drones in 2015, she developed a knack for effectively being in two places at once. While she follows the action on the ground, she also scans it from the sky and sees the elements forming as a much bigger picture. In drone images she captured near her home on Long Island, cow nose rays hunting for fish looked like sugar cubes, and autumnal trees resembled exploding fireworks. The cranberries she photographed in Massachusetts look like sheets of metallic red floating on an inky river. "It's a very spiritual experience for me," Steidel said. "The drone became an extension of myself in a way. I always ask Mother Nature, please help me capture what it is you want me to share with the world. It really opens your mind to multiple perspectives. Next, we'll move on to an article from the prologue section, A National Treasure, by Kayla Randall. A New Hope: How the Wiz Transformed an American Folktale into a Celebratory Vision for the Future of Black America. When Dwendolyn Reese was a kid in the 1970s, her mother took her to see the original Broadway production of The Wiz, the groundbreaking all-black stage adaptation of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Watching Stephanie Mills play the role of Dorothy and telling the story from this point of view, it made an impact, recalls Reese, who is now the Associate Director for the Humanities at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. The musical not only reimagined the story with black characters, but it also carved out its own identity, with new songs written by, among other artists, the composer Charlie Smalls and the R&B legend Luther Vandross. From Ease On Down the Road, a soulful take on Follow the Yellow Brick Road, to Everybody Rejoice / A Brand New Day. The latter song, like many Vandross classics, is jubilant, and its exaltations of liberation and hope take on a special meaning when sung by black characters, speaking to the long struggle for freedom. The show, directed by the Trinidad-born American actor and director Jeffrey Holder, who also designed the costumes, earned 7 Tony Awards, including Best Musical, Best Direction, and Best Costume Design. Sidney Lumet's 1978 film version, starring Diana Ross, Richard Pryor, and Michael Jackson, further cemented the story as part of American pop culture. Essential to The Wiz was, of course, The Wiz, played on Broadway by Andre DeShields. "This character was modern. He could have moved to soul music, and he had something to say," Reese says. "He wore a tight white jumpsuit, boots, and a spectacular emerald-lined cape. With that cape and collar," DeShields says in an interview with Smithsonian, "he's a superhero." DeShields, now 79, brought his electric style and charisma to the character. His famous introductory number is "So You Wanted to Meet the Wizard," and DeShields' Wiz was somebody everyone would want to meet. Even 50 years later, fresh off reprising a Tony-winning role in the Hadestown London West End, Shield remembers the creative joy of bringing the Wiz to life. That's the deliciousness of being an actor, he says. You become a chef. You get into that kitchen and you see what you've got in your cupboard. You can take a little of this and a little of that, a pinch of this and a pinch of that, a morsel of this and a morsel of that, and you throw it all together and you make something new, different, exciting, surprising, and medicinal. Underneath the Wiz's bravado, DeShield says, he's just as lost as young Dorothy, who only wants to get back home. He wears the mask of an all-powerful wizard to hide the fact that he's just an ordinary person. He discovers that by helping Dorothy and her friends realize that they have the brains, heart, and courage they sought all along, he's also empowering himself. Turns out he really was the Wiz all along, too. A big part of the show's identity is its distinctive look. Holder, describing his inspiration for the stage production in an interview years later, said, I wanted to make it an American fairy tale. And as Reese points out, the Wiz's costume aesthetics fits squarely in the realm of Afrofuturism, an artistic movement that blends black history with science fiction, fantasy, and other speculative elements. It also often specifically represents the African diaspora. At the heart of Afrofuturism, says Stephen Lewis, curator of music and performing arts at the museum, is wanting to celebrate and affirm not only African-American culture, but different black cultures around the world. Reese has previously described Holder's costume design as embodying his interest in African heritage, his own Caribbean upbringing, and his eventual diasporic perspective, which made the Wiz a down-to-earth folk interpretation of the original material. For example, Holder's Tin Man, which is also in the museum's collection, brings various influences together. His oil can was fashioned from a Dominican percussion instrument known as a güira. His hat was a skillet, and his beer can and scrap metal suit looks as though it was collected straight from the streets of American cities. Holder's designs feel rooted in the past while envisioning new horizons. As DeShields puts it, you cannot know where you're going if you do not know where you're coming from. And for a man who famously escapes Oz in a hot air balloon, the Wiz is fittingly dressed. His costume is a flight jumpsuit. It's a space suit, Reese says, symbolizing an endeavor that literally and figuratively exemplifies reaching new heights. That's liberation of aspiring towards space. That's a very clear message. Afrofuturism's message is still relevant, as is the Wiz's legacy. A new production of the musical is currently on national tour. Reflecting on Afrofuturism's special resonance for black audiences, DeShield zooms in on one word, imagination. His Wiz character, he says, created a persona to make it in the land of Oz, just as people do in reality. Our strongest tool for survival is the imagination. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.